Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Open enrollment has begun for those who get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act's individual marketplace. Like every year, the cost and number of plans in each county has changed from 2018 into 2019. This is the first year in Pennsylvania that has seen an overall decrease in premiums by 2.3%. Joining us this morning to answer questions about this year's open enrollment is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be back. This is one of those topics that we have a lot of questions about. So we have about a half hour with Commissioner Altman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, let's start with the rates going down. This had to be a pleasant surprise for many people across Pennsylvania. How was that able to happen?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it is that we're just seeing more stability in the marketplace. We're seeing the risk pool, or the people who have coverage through the individual market, staying relatively the same. We're seeing the insurers and the products and the networks stay relatively the same. And that's, you know, resulting in stabilization of claims, which means stabilization of prices. One thing I do always like to say is, you know, last year we should have had probably not a rate decrease, but a very low rate increase in Pennsylvania, about 6%. And the only reason that we didn't is because of decisions made at the federal level that directly impacted rates, like the end of the federal payments for the cost-sharing reduction program, where those payments now had to come out of premium. So in some ways, we're really in our second year of stability, really in our second year of thinking, maybe we're at a rate level that is actually appropriate to cover the costs of care in this market.
When you say that it's stabilized, though, it doesn't seem that way when you hear the news out of Washington. Granted, we are in election season where we have a lot of candidates talking about the possibility of repealing the Affordable Care Act, or what's health care going to look like. So how is it stabilized from a year ago? I was looking back at what we talked about last year at this time. And, you know, at that time, we were talking about repealing the individual mandate and some of those tax credits changes there. So how is it stabilized?
So I'm going to sort of split stability into two groups. One is stability of the rules that impact the market. And without question, there's been a lot of changes. There's been a lot of questions about what some of these changes mean for the market, what they're going to mean for premium. My department has put a lot of work into saying, how can we take these question marks that the federal government is creating and create consistency and give answers to the market space so that insurers aren't, it's not creating more uncertainty. It may have to be built into rates like we saw with cost-sharing reductions last year, and that amount is still built into rates this year because the federal government is still not making those payments. But at least we can provide that concrete answer and remove those question marks from the process. But the second category of stability is really what matters. You know, in the early years of this market, insurers felt there was a lot of instability in the costs of the claims, in the healthcare needs of the people they were serving. They were serving different people every year. They didn't know if they would need two primary care visits or extensive cancer treatment. They didn't know who was coming in the door. And that instability is what really was driving rate increases in the initial years of the ACA market. That was to some degree exacerbated because insurers then reacted by saying, uh-oh, we're going to then offer completely different plans than we were before. And then there was uncertainty back to the consumers as well. So there was a lot of back and forth, and that has really reached a point of stability. There's really more of an understanding of the patient population, of their healthcare needs, and therefore their costs. So when you take that, if you can appropriately respond to the federal changes, we can still have a stable market here in Pennsylvania while all that chaos is still going on in Washington, D.C., which to some degree it is.
So insurers, from what you're telling me, that second part, see the market in Pennsylvania as a little more stable, didn't know what to expect in the early years. I don't know whether you're in a position to answer this question, but what have insurers found about the marketplace? I mean, bottom line is when the Affordable Care Act was being debated during the Obama administration, one of the things we heard is that we would have a healthier population because more people would be going to the doctor. There would be more preventative health care. Are you in a position to say, hear from insurance companies that that's happened?
I can tell you a little bit about what some of the research has said. And there are a couple of things in this market that we've talked about for years. And to some degree, they're playing out. And to some degree, they're not. And to some degree, they conflict with one another. So one is this concept of pent-up demand. So there was this viewpoint that in the early years of the exchange, there were all of these people who had either been uninsured or underinsured for a significant period of time. And they were going to come in and get all of the care that they hadn't been getting for a large part of their life. They were going to come in and actually get appropriate treatment for their pre-existing conditions. And then, you know, in a couple of years, that would start to stave off as people were investing in preventive care, investing in chronic care management. I think people thought that would take 1 to 2, maybe 3 years. And what we've seen is it's really taken more like 4 to 5 to 6 years. But we are starting to see that leveling off that many were expecting to see in prior years. But that being said, early on, there was also a lot of discussion about how unhealthy the population that needed this market would be, what types of conditions were they likely to have. And I think in that, frankly, there was a lot of underestimation of the costs of the marketplace. I mean, we talked probably 2 years ago about how our market really was underpriced. In the first year of the health insurance exchange, Pennsylvania had the lowest cost plan in the country, not on average, but the cheapest plan available anywhere in the country was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But we then had, when we got on the back end and measured the population, the third unhealthiest population in this market in the country. So something was very wrong from the beginning. And that's been a part of the correction that's taken place through the significant rate increases that unfortunately have had to happen over the past couple of years.
I think about some of the things that occurred in the past, and I'm curious as to whether they're still happening. One of the things that we heard happen most often is that because there were so many people who didn't have a primary care physician, didn't go to the doctor very often, that when they were sick or had an illness or had a sick child, they would go to the emergency room in the hospital. Have those emergency room visits decreased?
I don't know that I have good data on that. I can tell you that there is a lot of effort in the individual market to connect people to primary care, to structure plans that drive people to lower cost points of care, whether it be primary care on a weekend, your urgent care, any of those places where, I mean, a doctor's visit might be $50, an urgent care visit might be $150, and an ER visit might be $1,500 for the same care that you might get across the board, depending on what's wrong. I mean, obviously, there are cases where you need to be in an emergency room and you should go there. We mostly see health maintenance organizations or HMOs in the individual market where you have to go to your primary care physician, receive referrals for non-emergency care. And so I would hope out of that that there would be an uptick in that connection between people and primary care and getting that upfront care that they need and not just always landing in an ER. But I don't have data for Pennsylvania.
All right, let me get back to rates. And I think it's always a good idea to ask how you decide rates when the insurance companies are providing you with information, data. Yeah. How do you decide on what a rate increase or, in this case, a rate decrease should be?
Right. So we get these really extensive rate filings from each company for each product they're going to sell in the individual market and actually also in the small group market, which this year is that serves small businesses, which this year is seeing a moderate increase. In those filings, we get information on claims experience, on how much you're paying the company paid out for pharmaceutical drugs and medical care, and what they're anticipating their medical trend is, meaning how much more they'll be paying in reimbursement to providers because medical costs do rise every year. Mm-hmm. Trends in morbidity, which means how sick the population is. All of these really, frankly, very complicated mathematical factors. And I actually employ a team of actuaries at my department, and we often seek further assistance from external actuaries as well to review those filings in great details. And at the end of the day, it really comes down to math, to evaluating how reasonable the assumptions in those filings are. And we do often push back and make insurers change some of those factors. And that's why in July, we announced a 0.7% increase has been requested. And now we're seeing on average a negative 2.3 decrease. That was us doing our job, evaluating those factors and pushing back. And if anyone's really interested, we actually do have a short 101 animated video on our website about how rates are decided. So if you're really interested, take a look at that. Or you could post it on your website.
I think we can do that.
Yeah.
Meredith, if you hear this, we can post that on our website. And what is the Department of Insurance's website?
Insurance.pa.gov.
Okay. I'm curious, those trends, with rate increases and insurance companies telling you trends, what trends are you seeing as far as what's costing more? Maybe something that's costing less.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in recent years, a lot of the attention has been on the increase in the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, right? A part of that has to do with the entrance of really expensive specialty drugs coming into the market. The most famous case over the past sort of half decade was the hepatitis C drugs that are life-changing, can actually cure a disease that hadn't been curable before, but one treatment for those can cost $60,000 to $100,000. And so some of those things and the entrance of those new medications when everybody wants them in 1 year can really drive increases in cost.
What did you push back on?
So we do.
I mean, I know you can't give all kinds of information, but an idea, if you can give me an example of something the department pushed back on.
Yeah. So one of the things we do is we look for outliers, right? So every insurance company is telling us this is how much healthier or unhealthier we think our population is going to be. That in technical terms is morbidity trend. If we see that one insurer is saying, you know, significantly higher than anyone else in the market, we're going to say, you're going to need to give us data. You're going to need to prove that. And if you can't, you're going to need to bring that down. So that's an example of an area where we would, and this year did push back in certain cases.
Morbidity trend.
Morbidity trend.
It sounds so impersonal. I guess we're all on our way there. So you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Our guest today is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act exchange started last week on November 1st, and it goes through December 15th this year. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that's at smarttalkwitf, 1-800-729-7532. Commissioner, I want to read an email we received. Gentleman says that premiums may be down 2 or 3%. Actually, it's 2.3%, but the overall monthly payment is what matters. Subsidies must be down in York County because my monthly payment for the same insurance is up to $500 a month from $150 a month. Now, something we should mention overall is that overall rates are down 2.3%. Everyone is impacted differently. What about that? I mean, and the point he makes is a good one. If you hear that rates overall are down 2.3%, but yet you're paying $350 more a month, you're not very happy.
Yeah. So first of all, the negative 2.3% is a statewide average. And so there are cases where rates will go up moderately. But when you get into the subsidy, one of the really complicated and often hard to explain things about this market is that it is possible for the price of the plan you have to go down and the price that you pay for it to go up after that subsidy. Now, I'm going to explain the reason for that. The reason for that is that the subsidy you get is based off of the premium price of what is the second lowest cost silver plan available to you.
Okay,
I know.
The ahead.
Second cheapest silver plan in your area is what the tax credit is based on. Now, when you have premiums change every year, the relative price between plans can change. And of course, this year, in addition to lower rates, we're seeing large expansions of plans. So 30 of Pennsylvania's 67 counties will have more insurers offering coverage compared to last year, including really this whole central region of the state. And what that does is that means maybe the plan you had last year was the second cheapest or the third cheapest. Maybe this year it's the fifth or sixth cheapest. But this is why, and the message we put out every year is, in this market, it is absolutely critical that every year you shop. Because just because the plan that you had last year, that you're getting that notice saying, if you renew in that plan this year, this is going to be your cost. If you went back in and you looked at the subsidy and you looked at the plans that were perhaps newly available or cheaper than they were last year, you could find a different plan that could be the price you were paying last year. It could be even less. It depends on what's available in your area and where the prices of the plans benchmark to that subsidy and that second lowest cost silver plan, which is very complicated, but that's how it works.
Money is a big factor, but not the only factor.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are those that were comfortable with the plan that they've had in the past mm-hmm. because it meant that they could go to this doctor. They change plans, they may not be able to go to that doctor, may not be a network. So there are other factors to consider, right?
Absolutely. And having your doctor in the network is one of them. Knowing whether you want a plan where you can go to a specialist on your own or need your primary care doctor to approve it. And then also if you are reliant on pharmaceutical drugs, understanding the formulary and the price of different drugs within different plans is critical. You know, we actually offer on our website a tool called Checkbook, which is a plan comparison tool. It has only ACA compliant plans on it. You can put in, it's really fast. You put in your income, your zip code, your age, do you smoke or not, some really quick questions, and it'll give you the comparison of plans in your area. But it also has very special functions where you can say, here's a doctor that's really important to me to have in the network. Then the tool will tell you which plans have that doctor in the network. Here's a drug that's really important for me to have on the formulary. That tool will tell you all of those things. So healthcare.gov does have those functions as well, but it's a much longer process to get through because they're also determining your eligibility for subsidies, which our tool is really just meant to be, here's a way to shop to understand your options as you prepare to go through that longer process.
How many plans do we have this year?
So it really varies by county. It could be as few as probably 3 to 5 and as many as potentially 20. But I'm just citing, amounts. I didn't actually look that up. But it really is varied. You know, in this central area now, so we've always had Highmark plans, Capital Blue Cross plans, and Geisinger plans, and we now generally have UPMC following their purchase of Pinnacle in this area. So plans in this area, generally, there are more available this year than last year.
I always, when we do this, I always look for changes from the year before, from the past. Tax credits. I mean, mm-hmm. this is something that Washington has been making some changes in. How are individuals impacted by any changes made in tax credits?
Sure. So the tax credit in the way of meaning it as the subsidy that helps
yes.
you pay your premium,
yes.
that's still there. It hasn't changed. Now, it can change, as we've talked about, how much you get and how much that is relative to the price of the plan you may want. But that's always been the structure of those subsidies. And also for those of you out there who receive an additional subsidy called the cost-sharing reduction that helps you pay your deductible, your copay, your coinsurance, that is also still there. The one thing changing for 2019 2015 compared to the current 2018 year is the penalty for not having insurance. The tax penalty would be zero. So there isn't a penalty if you choose to forgo insurance. But of course, that doesn't mean you should choose to forgo insurance. There are many good reasons why you should have insurance, the most basic of which is protecting you, your family, your loved ones in the case where you have an unpredicted healthcare event that could be of significant cost, and without insurance, you wouldn't have the ability to pay.
That's just to clarify, because there always is confusion when this is reported. You're talking about the individual mandate.
Correct.
So just it's 2019 where that would go into effect.
Correct. So for those of you currently enrolled in health insurance for the 2018 plan year, so for this current year we're in, where you will file taxes this coming April, that penalty is still there. So don't give up that health insurance if you're afraid of that penalty. So it's really for the 2019 year of coverage for when you will file taxes in April of 2020.
So I mentioned December 15th. Mm-hmm. That is compared, now last year was short as well. It was reduced by the Trump administration. December 15th this year, you know, maybe give us an idea of some dates. What happens December 15th, and can you get insurance after December 15th?
Sure. So open enrollment launched last Thursday, November 1st, and it goes through December 15th. Now, this is for the individual health insurance market. Medicare open enrollment is happening. It has slightly different dates. Many employers have their open enrollment this same time of year. But for if you buy insurance for yourself, for your family, on healthcare.gov, this is the open enrollment period until December 15th. If we get past that December 15th deadline, you can only get individual market Affordable Care Act robust comprehensive coverage if something significant changes in your life. Have a child, get married, get divorced. Significant life changes that will get you a special enrollment period is what the technical term is. But absent those changes, you need to enroll by December 15th.
One of the changes, and you were on our program a few months ago talking about it, was what were referred to as short-term insurance mm-hmm. policies that have been expanded by the Trump administration. And at the time, you said this is not part of the Affordable Care Act. We've had a few months since this has been implemented. What do you see? Do you still recommend against those? What are they?
Yeah, so short-term limited duration plans were meant to be exactly what they're called. They were meant to fill very short gaps in coverage. You know, maybe you're leaving a job and taking 2 months off before you start your next one. And so they're very minimal coverage. They're structured to fill these short gaps. And the best description that I've actually heard of them, about them, is Swiss cheese, because there are such limitations on coverage, such exclusions on coverage, right? Most of them don't have coverage for any pharmaceutical drugs, for maternity coverage, for any mental health or substance use disorder treatment. Many of them have exclusions. I was just reading a story, I think it was in USA Today, about an exclusion for if you participate in extreme sporting events or go, you know, even ski jumping, right? They won't cover those things because you intentionally chose to participate in those activities. So, and they can exclude you if you have a pre-existing condition. Not only can they say, no, we're not going to cover you at all, they can say, well, we'll cover you, but we'll charge you way more. Or they can say, well, we'll cover you, but we're not covering anything related to that condition at all. So these are really the things that we saw before the Affordable Care Act, the holes that people fell into when they needed coverage, when they wanted coverage. And even if they had something that they called a health insurance plan, that coverage really wasn't there for them at the end of the day. So what I tell consumers is educate yourselves. Ask the right questions. I understand the lower premium can seem appealing, but it's lower for a lot of significant reasons.
So my regular insurance plan covers ski jumping?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, it won't pay for your ski pass, but it'll pay if you get injured while doing it.
Oh, and I'm sure that would happen if I attempted that. A couple emails here. Jack writes, some politicians promote the idea of purchasing health insurance across state lines. It's my understanding that any insurer selling coverage in Pennsylvania needs to be approved by the insurance commission. In addition, a policy sold from another state would not have network agreements with doctors and hospitals. Why do politicians try to sell the populace this idea when it doesn't seem feasible? I don't know whether you can answer that question or not, because I think that's kind of a given. The answer to that question is obvious. But let's talk about, because this is something that, he's right, a lot of people have said, well, this is how we will create more competition and rates will go down if insurance companies were allowed to sell premium, or excuse me, policies across state lines.
Yeah, so that person had a lot of it right. I mean, we hear a lot that it's all about the regulatory barriers. It's all about the fact that any insurer who wants to sell to Pennsylvanians has to have a license with my department. If they want to sell a plan here, they have to have their plan approved by my department. You know, what we hear from insurers and what we know just from understanding the way that insurance works, and particularly health insurance works, is that's not the problem. The problem is the network. The problem is that if you want to offer insurance in this area that is useful to the people that live in this area, you need to have agreements with the providers who provide service in this area, right? And that is a timely and costly endeavor to invest in those agreements. And frankly, you're going to do a lot better job negotiating favorable pricing that will result in lower premiums when you have a lot of enrollees to negotiate on, right? That economies of scale. You can say, well, you know, if I'm coming to you saying, I think I'll have 500 people coming into your doctor's office, or I know I will have 20,000 people coming into your system, that's a very different economic argument. And that's why the insurers who are here, who have built their networks here, who have their enrollment bases built here, are going to get better pricing than those who might want to try to come in from the outside.
Have you been approached by out-of-state, out-of-Pennsylvania companies?
You know, it doesn't even entirely work like that. I mean, no, I haven't had XYZ plan from Arkansas or ABC plan from Nebraska calling and saying, can you offer here? Because they can. If they want to offer here, come on in. Insurers know how to get a license. They know how to get a product approved. And if they wanted to do that, they would do it.
They could do it right now.
Of course they could.
Okay. Another quick email here. This is kind of a long one, but I'll just do a few sentences because we do have to move on to our second segment here. Understand that in January, Pennsylvania will lose the insurance discounts for the universal health insurance. This may also be nationwide, but the concern is Pennsylvania with this note. Also, that the state has not renewed the ability to have association discounts and co-op so that businesses and individuals can come together and receive better health care rates. So no longer joining a chamber or business association helps reduce any health care cost. So as a small business owner and or individuals, we will be rated on age, smoking, non-smoking, and zip code for health care rates. If this is all true, and I've heard it from several insurance carriers, brokers, I'm wondering why more folks in this position aren't bringing awareness to not talking about this change.
So, you know, trying to tease out exactly what that question is asking. So the first part mentioned something about losing discounts on universal health care. I actually don't know what that means. You know, like I said, the subsidies that are in place, the discounts that are made available to consumers in the individual market, the Medicaid expansion, none of that is going away. You know, the second part of the question clearly gets to this concept of association health plans. This past summer, at the same time that the Trump administration made those short-term plans more readily available, they also issued a rule at the federal level that aimed to and purported to make something called association health plans more readily available by saying different groups of people with looser connections to to one another can sort of pool together and buy coverage. That's a very complicated rule. And here in Pennsylvania, it's especially complicated because we have a lot of state law that also applies here. And the reason we have that state law is that back when these types of plans were very popular, we saw, and actually at the time, states were preempt from regulating them. They were purely federally regulated. And we saw fraud, sham plans, these sort of so-called associations coming in and saying, we're going to collect your premium, but we actually have no intention of ever paying for your care. And some really tragic circumstances arose from that at the time. We also saw well-intentioned associations who just didn't have the financial wherewithal, never wanted to say no, never wanted to charge more, who at the end of the day just didn't collect enough money to pay what they were going to need to pay. And so when the federal government changed the rules to allow joint jurisdiction with the states, which happened well before this rule, Pennsylvania passed some of our own laws to put some safeguards on who can sell these plans and how they can be sold. And those are for very good reason. So my guess is those latter things are what are being heard on the street by agents. But it's just a lot of detail and a lot of complication as to the rules.
Bottom line, though, is that what she was saying, is that accurate, that there will be fewer plans available through associations?
So the bottom line is association health plans are allowed in Pennsylvania, but we do have some more stringent requirements and restrictions that may ultimately limit their availability because of that.
Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Next week is National Education Week, and it's a good time to discuss one of the most important issues or topics in Pennsylvania's future, and that is education. Joining us on today's program is Jeff Nye, who is Pennsylvania State Education Association's treasurer. Mr. Nye, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Welcome to be. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us is Ronald Cowell, who is from the Education Policy and Leadership Center. Mr. Cowell, welcome back to the show.
Hey, glad to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, I know it's hard to boil education and all the issues and all the challenges faced in education down to a 20-minute segment, but we wanted to do this the week before National Education Week. Let's start off with what is National Education Week, Jeff?
National Education Week is that week that we can honor the profession of public education, and we take each one of the days of the week and we kind of single-handedly pick out different things to make sure that we honor and to make sure that we are promoting the great things that are happening in public education, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country.
And this is something that's been around since 1921, and it was started by the National Education Association. And the sense I got was that it was mostly for teachers, correct?
It is mostly for teachers, but it has grown so much since then. We've brought in the communities, we've brought in our support professionals, and we take each one of those segments of our education population and we honor and we make sure that they are recognized for the great work that is being done every single day.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the themes of next week?
So we have Monday that starts off with just the opening day, just to honor the whole thing with Education Week, and then we roll into where we have our Support Professionals Day. We have a Parents Day that we bring people in for the parents to see exactly what's going on. We have a day that is a Celebrity Educator Day, so we bring other people in to kind of see what happens in a day-to-day process, and then we wrap everything up on a Friday.
Mm-hmm. So National Education Week, just saw it as a good opportunity to talk about some of the challenges that educators face in this country, and wanted to talk about some of those. And they don't all, you know, are not all just focused on teachers or, you know, some of the people actually in the school buildings. So let's talk about those. And Ron Cowell, I'm going to bring you in just a moment here. But
sure.
let's talk about something that we've been experiencing here in Pennsylvania, but it has been a problem, is a problem across the country. The Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, reports that in the 2016-17 school year, there were teacher shortage areas in a number of different subject matters. English as a second language, foreign languages, life and physical sciences, the secondary level, mathematics, grades 7 through 12, special education, pre-K all the way through 12, hearing impaired, nursery school through grade 12, speech and language impaired, nursery through grade 12. Give me a sense of what kind of teacher shortage we're talking about in those areas.
The unfortunate part is that the teacher shortages are across all of those areas plus more. Even in the down to the elementary, which is where I come from, we have all of these shortages all over the place. Just this past 5 years, from 5 years ago to now, we probably have a third of the people going into education that we did before. It is just one of those areas where, unfortunately, people just don't seem to have that calling to go into education. And it's probably for various reasons. A lot of them are the societal norms. A lot of it has to do with pay, because we are not giving the respect that education should have as far as their pay to make sure that they are having a living wage. I mean, it is a shame that we still have a couple of our districts out there. We have starting salaries at $18,200 in this state for a starting teacher. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it's stopping a lot of people from entering the profession.
$18,000 to start.
Correct.
That's a full-time teacher.
That is.
Now, where is that? I mean, are there certain areas of the state where they only pay $18,000 a year?
More to the central western part of the state.
Ron Cowell, you deal with a whole host of education issues. Why do you think there's a teacher shortage?
Well, first, we have the luxury in Pennsylvania of more than 90 teacher preparation programs. That's been an asset for us for generations. However, those programs have experienced a dramatic reduction in the number of enrollees. So the number of students enrolled in teacher preparation programs today are about 50% or less of what they were 5, 6, 7 years ago. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. One, we've created a most unwelcoming environment for teachers. If you're a young person today in high school or even in college thinking about what you want to do, we've got too many people, particularly politicians, who beat up on teachers on a pretty regular basis. And if they're not beating up on teachers, they pat them on the head and tell them good luck, but don't expect to make a lot of money the rest of your life. If you're a smart young person today, you understand that because of the big budget cuts that occurred at the state level in 2011, more than 10,000 teachers were furloughed across the state. And even today, year in and year out, again, if you're a smart young person paying attention to the news, you're constantly reading about school districts facing budget cuts and considering more furloughs because of the inadequacy of state funding. And this particularly hits hard the poor districts around the state that are most dependent on adequate support from state government. Just a reminder also, we changed the pension system. The legislature changed the pension system a couple of years ago. So if you're a young person entering state government, but particularly in this case, teacher programs or a position as a teacher, the pension system is far less lucrative starting in 2019 than it has been. So, young people thinking about where do I want to make my career? And will I have a decent pension after spending 30 or 35 years of my life at this? And then the final thing I'd note is all of this important issue around school safety is of concern to a lot of young people, too. And the young people that I speak with in teacher preparation programs are particularly concerned by the suggestion that they ought to start to carry guns. That's the last thing they tell me. That's the last thing they want to do. They want to work with kids, not have to be expected to carry a gun. So it's a really unwelcoming environment. On the other hand, I just said to a class at Johnstown, the University of Pittsburgh, 2 weeks ago, the shortage creates wonderful opportunities then. If you are a dedicated young person who wants to work with children, who you have a dedication to education as a profession and as a career, there are plenty of opportunities that are going to be out there now because of this unprecedented shortage that we're facing in Pennsylvania.
Unprecedented? Really?
I've been around this business for 45 years now. And for all of my 45 years until the last couple, we were talking about a surplus production of teachers in Pennsylvania. 20, 25, 30 years ago when I was in the legislature, folks in North Carolina and Georgia and Virginia used to thank me at national meetings that we were sending our surplus teachers to those southern states who had a serious shortage at that time. But we have shifted now from being a surplus provider to actually having a shortage, as you indicated in your note and as Jeff noted in his comments.
How do we compare with other states, especially those surrounding us, Jeff?
I believe that I don't have the facts sitting here in front of me. We have heard when we go to our national conventions that there is shortages in other states. But even right here in Pennsylvania, it really shows itself down to the bedrock. Even when you go into the schools today, even substitute teachers, we are having such a shortage there. And similar to the things that Ron has been saying, getting into the profession and staying into the profession because of some of the ways that it's been demonized or the salaries just aren't there. People just can't afford sometimes to go into a certain school district, substitute in Pennsylvania, and then hopefully get a job. We've got sub shortages all across the state, and that then puts another tax on the teachers that are already there because classrooms have to be covered by missing prep time to make great lessons that we have going on in the school. So it's just all over the place.
Ron,
I'll give you another example of a consequence. I just had a text from an arts education leader this morning, and she said, you know, we ought to be noting that she, as an arts teacher, is often called to substitute in other classrooms where they can't find a qualified sub in math or science, whatever it might be. So the students have an art teacher instead of a science teacher, and her art students go without art class that day. So there are some tangential consequences as well.
You know, when I hear this, you know, it makes me wonder, do we value education? I don't know who wants to take that, but go ahead, Ron.
Well, I think we do. If you ask people, do they value education?
I think when you ask them,
They tend to say yes. Very importantly, the national survey data over the last month or 3 months now reports that we have a growing appreciation for the value of and the importance of teachers. And a majority of Americans have said that they believe teachers are underpaid and deserve greater pay. Now, that's national data, but I think that same kind of sentiment exists here in Pennsylvania. The challenge is, here in Pennsylvania, and that's what I'll talk about, we have the most unequal system of opportunity of any of the states in the country. By that, I mean the gap between the have and the have-not school districts is the greatest in the country. In a lot of states, that's unconstitutional. In Pennsylvania, so far, it's been constitutional, and it's been made even worse by actions of the legislature in terms of underfunding K-12 education in Pennsylvania. So rich districts, they can do it alone. Their taxpayers pay a lot. They make an enormous contribution, but they manage. But in poor districts, they don't have the resources, they don't have the tax base, and in a lot of instances, they don't have the teacher corps as well.
You know, something, Jeff, that Ron just brought up, and he said about taxpayers in those richer school districts paying a good bit. Let's face it, there are a lot of poorer school districts where taxpayers are adding up a lot as well. That's one of the keys here, is that, yes, you ask 1,000 people on the street, 998 of them are going to say education is one of the most important things that we face for our future. We must educate our children. That's the key to any kind of success we have as a nation, we have as a state. But when asked, are you willing to pay for that, I mean, because of the model that we have, then the answers kind of change. And I can understand that. Someone asked me, do I want to pay more in property taxes? The answer is no. So, you know, that's the real push and pull here.
As a society as a whole, you're absolutely right. We do value what education does. Just take a look at mainstream television, whether it's a commercial or TV shows that you have. They always put some kind of educator in the forefront when they're trying to sell a product. So obviously, people do value the job that educators do, and they trust what educators say. But you're also right. It's a snowball effect, especially when you get to some of these poorer districts, because you have these families that are doing everything they can to make ends meet, which oftentimes means making doing double jobs, so they have very little time with their students, with their children, to make sure that they are school ready, which means the school now has to step in and make sure that they are giving the kids the resources they have to be successful and to be part of that community. And it just keeps going round and round. You're right. The more affluent school districts or have the resources, you have those things that are available. What we need to do is we need to invest in education more and more, especially in these cities and towns that don't have that tax base, to make sure that they are getting the adequate funding that they have to make sure that those kids are coming out of those schools with the absolute best education possible.
So
I don't want to kill your listeners with numbers, but you make an important point about property taxes and the burden of property taxes. In Pennsylvania, more than 45% of our K-12 money comes from property taxes. Nationally, it's less than 30%. So we're about 150% dependent on property taxes compared to the national average. And that's a direct result of the legislature, in my words, being cheap about supporting K-12 education in this state. We rank in the bottom five in terms of the share of K-12 costs paid for by state government. When the state is cheap, the burden falls on local taxpayers, and in Pennsylvania that usually means property taxes.
By the way, if you would like to call in, we have about 7 minutes left. Call in with a question or comment. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You also could send us an email, or I should say a tweet on Twitter. We're at SmartTalkWITF. So, Ron, what kind of incentives can we use? I mean, I think about like medical students, for example, getting incentives that maybe there will be some debt relief, some student debt relief, if they agree to serve somewhere. Can we do that with, do we do that with teachers, maybe in some school districts where they are having a real teacher shortage problem, or in some of these areas, these subject matters that we were discussing earlier?
Well, because there's a national shortage, there are a lot of experiments and pilots and efforts being made all over the country, and some of them are right here in Pennsylvania. Let me note one aspect of this that we have not talked about yet, and that is the fact that in Pennsylvania, we have a terrible position in terms of teachers of color in the classroom. My organization did a report more than 10 years ago when we said that less than 5% of our teachers were teachers of color. We are worse today than we were 10 years ago. And so there are some important initiatives coming out of the Pennsylvania Department of Education and various communities around the state to recruit more Latinos and African Americans to the teacher profession. And those are important efforts, and I think they're beginning to bear fruit, at least in terms of folks entering teacher preparation programs. But you mentioned the idea of loan forgiveness. That's another example of something that we could be doing, but it's related to state policy that has led us to have the highest public higher education tuition in the country. Again, we're not very generous. We're 47th or 48th in the country in terms of state support for higher education. That translates to high tuition. That translates to high student indebtedness. So if we can help students who want to enter teaching as a profession and will stay in teaching as a profession, maybe some loan forgiveness can be an important asset. But it's got to be broad. It can't just be a pilot program. I remember Senator Schwartz more than 20 years ago put it into place for early education programs. But it was so late and so small. It was like winning the lottery. It didn't influence decision-making on a part of young people in any way. So if we want to create incentives, they have to be broad. They have to be certain. It's got to be a guarantee that the benefit is going to be there once you make a commitment to teaching.
You know, Ron, I don't know, and I'm catching you off guard here, but I just caught Jeff off guard, too. I mean, this is too important a topic to have just a short conversation. Jeff says that he's available tomorrow. Ron, you available tomorrow for about a half hour?
I'm just looking at a schedule here. Yes.
Okay, let's do this.
About the same time I could do it.
All right, let's do this again tomorrow, and because there's a lot of other topics. I should have known that just for 25 minutes, talk about education, that would be not enough time, but this is a first. You guys are pioneers. I've never done this on the air where I've invited guests on the spot, but we have a couple callers here. If you will call in tomorrow, we will do this between 9 and 9:35. tomorrow, where we're talking about teacher shortages and some of the other challenges facing education. One of the things I do want to talk about, Jeff, tomorrow, and that is one of the challenges that school districts are facing having to do with the mandates on school districts from the state. Even though there's not more money coming from the state, well, there is more, put it that way. The percentages don't go up a whole lot, but school districts are mandated for a whole lot. Just quickly, how much of an issue is that facing school districts?
Depending upon what mandate we're actually talking about, I mean, there are a lot of things that educators across the board know what the students need, and they want to be able to deliver those things. Those mandates every once in a while kind of get in the way because now we have to take away from certain aspects of education to deal with these mandates. For example, testing. Okay, so testing eats up so much of the school day throughout the course of the year, and then we have to stop education altogether for a long time now. Legislation has now reduced our testing, which we thank the legislation very much for doing so, but it's still there, and teachers still have to eat up most of their time, and unfortunately, they're teaching to a test, which does not necessarily measure the growth for that student where they would put it in the hands of the educators.
And we're going to stop right there and pick it up tomorrow at 9 a.m. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today and making yourselves available tomorrow. Jeff Nye, Pennsylvania State Education Association, and Ron Cow from the Education Policy and Leadership Center. Get your questions ready because we'll have them on tomorrow's program. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you know what's coming up on tomorrow's program. I don't even have to promote. Just did that because we're going to be talking more about education the week before National Education Week.